connection with IFRS 17. I give the floor to Andrea.
Yes, so the papers this evening continue the ISB's discussion in the light of the concerns and implementation challenges we've heard since the standard was issued last year. We've got six papers today which address many of the topics that we raised to your awareness in October, and we expect the remaining papers covering the remaining issues will be presented to you and discussed at the first couple of months of next year. From developing these papers, we've continued with the extensive engagement and outreach with stakeholders that we've done throughout the project, and we've also reviewed a number of suggestions and proposals by stakeholders, and as you'll see, the output of, or the input from all of that has been reflected in the papers that you have before you. So with that, I think we will start, and we're working through them in the order that they're presented, A to F, and so we'll start with paper 2A.
Thank you, Andrea. So paper 2A, presentation of insurance contract on the statement of financial position. Agenda paper 2A presents a staff analysis on three of the 25 topics presented at the October board meeting. This paper first discussed the need to allocate premium cash flows and the liability for incurred claims to each group of insurance contracts. This topic covers item 9 from the October paper about premiums received under the premium allocation approach, and item 15 from the October paper about the separate presentation of groups of assets and groups of liabilities. Both those items from the October paper were raised as a result of practical challenges identified by stakeholders in allocating amounts to groups of contracts and are focused on the unit of account for the purpose of presentation on the statement of financial position. The second topic discussed in this paper is the separate presentation and measurement of premiums receivable and claims payable. This topic corresponds to item 16 of the October board paper. While this topic is also related to the presentation of insurance contract on the statement of financial position, it is different because it is focused on the separate presentation of certain components of the unit of account on the statement of financial position and the separate measurement of these components. Concerns related to this topic are more conceptual and arise because the presentation requirements in IFRS 17 are different to the presentation that is commonly used under existing practice. Therefore, we propose to discuss the second topic separately from the first one. Sorry. So we'll start with the first topic, the need to allocate premiums cash flows and the liability for incurred claims to each group of insurance contracts. IFRS 17 requires an entity to present the combination of rights and obligations arising from a group of insurance contracts as a single asset or liability for insurance contract, and prohibits the entity from offsetting groups of insurance contract in an asset position with groups of insurance contract in a liability position on the balance sheet. Some stakeholders stated a significant implementation challenge arises because to determine if a group of insurance contract is an asset or is a liability position, there's a need to allocate cash flows or premium cash flows and the liability for incurred claims to each group of insurance contracts. Those stakeholders observe that entities currently maintain information about cash receipts and payments only at an aggregated level that is higher than a group. Some stakeholders are concerned that it will be complex and costly to develop new systems to identify premium received, claims incurred, and other separately managed balances for each group of contracts. Consequently, stakeholders have questions whether the information arising from the presentation requirements in IFRS 17 is sufficiently useful for users of the financial statements to justify just such costs. Based on the analysis included in the paper, staff think that there is merit in providing a practical relief for entities. However, we note that any practical relief would introduce offsetting and be contrary to the general requirements of the conceptual framework. On balance, staff recommend that entities are required to offset groups at a portfolio level for presentation purposes. Staff consider this proposed amendment meet the criteria set by the board at its October meeting because the loss of information could be regarded as acceptable when balanced against the significant cost relief, and such amendment might significantly reduce implementation costs and simplify implementation for many entities. Therefore, I hand over to the board for discussion.
Thank you. Although I have a strong sympathy to the preparers, I'm not happy with the staff's proposal. I have several reasons. First, this proposal is not consistent with our conceptual framework, IS1, and also it is not consistent with our previous decision about IS32, which prohibit net presentation for the master netting agreement. With the contract with master netting agreement, with the sacrifice of US GAAP convergence. So we think it is quite important to be consistent with those decisions and our principles. So that's the first reason. And the second reason is actually insurer will manage their contract with a group basis. So if we net off it, to the portfolio basis, it will cause a significant loss of information. And moreover, the one thing I have a strong concern is nobody knows how much is the impact. Nobody knows how material the significant difference is. So that is quite dangerous situation. And the third reason is I understand preparer needs system change. It causes a lot of cost. However, I think it is one-off cost. Although the cost could be significant, but we already have 1 year deferral. So then, although it's a significant cost, but it's just one-year one-off cost. On the other hand, the loss of information lasts forever unless we change the proposal. So without knowing the materiality of the loss of information, and loss of information continues forever, but the cost is one of costs. So comparing those two, I think even though it is a huge cost for preparer, I think we need to ask them to bear the cost. And finally, I have some concern with our proposal because the difference between group and the portfolio is annual cohort. And the annual cohort itself is a significant issue, but we require them to do the annual cohort. But on the other hand, we can allow them netting off for the portfolio basis is inconsistent. What we are requiring and what we are allowing is inconsistent. Therefore, all in all, I'm not happy with your proposal.
Sure. I certainly agree with tax arguments in terms of concepts and consistency with 32, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's, for me, indisputable. But I agree with the staff's recommendation, given the feedback that I've heard from preparers in terms of the cost, and I think the balance of the additional cost relative to the loss of information. Mm-hmm. This wouldn't affect, you know, the measures of profitability and some of those things that we're particularly focused on in IFRS 17. So while there's some loss of information, given the relief that I be provided in terms of reducing the need for systems changes because of this interaction between sort of cash systems and actuarial accounting systems, I think on balance that I would agree with the staff recommendation.
Françoise.
I also would agree with the staff recommendation. I think I think the argument of trade-off between the supplementary benefit and the cost, and I rely on you for the source of information you've gotten about the importance of the costs. is important. But I also note that there are two differences, I think, that make me reasonably comfortable with not aligning with IS-32 in this case. First of all, IFRS 17 allows that the measurement of the expected cash flows be made at portfolio level, and that people may rely on an allocation mechanism towards groups. So a portfolio of contracts, similar risks managed together as a pool, to me is a good basis for doing this. And we have also acknowledged in IFRS 17 that the notion of grouping contracts together made sense and was a good reflection of the business model of insurance. So we have also grounds there to be different from what we've done elsewhere.
Martin.
Yeah, I also support the staff recommendation. When this topic was discussed at length at the TRG, and when I was not aware of this, that really in the insurance industry, really there is not a great link between the kind of, I would say, systems between payables, receivables, and really the system where it was accounting. And that was brought to our attention at the TRG. There is not any linkage between the systems world in most of the insurance companies. And it was brought to our attention, okay, if they want to then allocate really receivables, premium receivables, but also incurred claims into this grouping, they need to really link in these two kind of system worlds, and that could cost in certain companies a two-digit million number. And then for me, the overall case is here a cost-benefit consideration. And I think really, what is really the information value? Is it so much higher if you do that based on a group level or do that on a portfolio level and compare that to the cost? And based on that, I would really happy with the recommendation from the staff that we can give some cost relief here and cost-benefit consideration. I totally agree what Tuck has said. It is not in line with our conceptual framework, but I think overall, I think also the conceptual framework is saying we should take into account cost-benefit consideration. And for me in this regard, I think that is a kind of thing where this is in line, and I have always said also as a THG, man, if we have new information, I think we can do something and do something. And as I said, for me, it was new that the system are not so linked and that is so big cost for them. And therefore, I would be happy to agree with staff recommendations.
Nick.
Thank you. I mean, as others said, it's clearly important to recognize, acknowledge the inconsistency this creates with the conceptual framework. Having said that, I also understand that the cost implications are for preparers here in making this transition. And finally, to reflect on some targeted outreach we've done with users that feel that this would be acceptable, there wouldn't be undue loss of information from moving to the portfolio level. And so in that respect, I support the staff recommendation.
Mary?
I'll say cautious support for the staff recommendation, and the reason I characterize it that way is both messaging and outreach. On this proposed change is one that I think normally would fail the criterion that we set in October of not reducing information and the usefulness of information. But you've got important information about the relative benefit of the group level separation versus the new information Martin referred to about the cost, because I'm another person who agrees with Tuck's analysis of the significance of this, a change at a conceptual level. I just fall more like Francois on the other side of the cost benefit based on what we know, but I think it's going to be very important that during outreach, we specifically seek to talk to as many users as possible to ensure that we have the right understanding of the benefit that they ascribe to the information that will be lost as a result of this change. And if we learn anything new, I think we'll have to evaluate it again, because it is, conceptual override, and it is, inconsistent with the, not losing information criterion that we set in October. The other thing I think we have to be cautious about is the messaging. that it's not a general move to the portfolio, that there's no change in terms of the measurement requirements for the insurance contract obligation, which remains at a group level. It's solely relief for presentation, and also that it is portfolio as defined in the standard, not whatever portfolio aggregation an entity might use for its internal management. So I think to not get people overexcited about what the change is from either a positive or negative perspective, clarity, not just in the technical document, but in the messaging about what it is important. So that plus outreach.
Chungu.
Thank you. I agree with your staff recommendation, but as Mary just explained, we are talking about at the level of a presentation, not recognition measurement.
Yes.
Everything is the same as before.
Yeah.
The one clarification, I'm curious, is if we just amend at the level of a presentation as a group, no, as a portfolio, so we are going to have all kinds of groups that's recognized, measured by the current principles. In that case, you are saying there is an offsetting effect among these groups.
Yes.
In a portfolio.
In the balance sheet. Yes. On the face of balance sheet.
On the presentation on the balance sheet.
Yes.
So what is the difference between their, we just amend their presentation level as a portfolio, keeping recognition measurement level as a group. And another one is we just make all total amendments at three levels, recognition measurement and presentation. At all these levels, we are going to use as a unit of account a portfolio. Then these two, the final outcome of these two approaches seems to me quite similar.
So it's not exactly similar. So for the measurement purposes, we're still going to manage each group separately, and group is a part of a portfolio, and annual cohort concept is there. So the results that we're going to have on the statement of on the profit or loss will be based on that unit of account, the group. What we have currently in the requirements is that we need to take all the groups that their balance are assets and put them on the asset side, and all the groups that their total balance at the end of the day is liability and put them on the liability side. That was very difficult for companies to do because some of the cash flows they cannot allocate between groups based on current systems. So what we are proposing is not to change the measurement at all. It's just taking all the groups in a certain portfolio together for presentation purpose, identifying all the portfolios that are assets, putting them on the asset side, and all the portfolios after collecting all the groups within them that are liabilities on the liability side. So there is a bit of offsetting between groups in portfolios, but for measurement purposes in the P&L, nothing will change at all. But it helps in terms of implementation. It helps a lot for preparers because they don't need to allocate certain cash flows to get the same outcome for them.
Thank you. This is exactly the point I have a concern, because there is a disconnection between recognition and measurement and the presentation. And normally, if you recognize the measure, a unit of account basis, so then it should be easy to present growth basis. But the preparer says there is a disconnection. So I wonder, there is a problem of internal control. And we say that in IFRS 17, unit of account is group basis. And we think this is the right accounting. So if this is the right accounting, they have to manage to make a system of measurement of the recognition. Then it should automatically relate to the presentation of financial position. Otherwise, it's disconnected. And without knowing what is the impact, it is really dangerous. That is my concern. And everybody says the cost-benefit basis, but I don't think it's a cost. I think it's a benefit for the insurer to develop the system to meet the measurement recognition and the presentation. So therefore, even if it's it's an expense. However, it's a kind of benefit for the insurer to develop this system in this opportunity to switch to IFRS 17.
Daryl.
So I think Tuck and Chung-Wu, my thinking about this, I think you're probably right, is that these two issues have some relationship between them. But I think there's probably two things that become quite important, and bearing in mind that we will presumably discuss groups at some point in the future, the grouping thing from a measurement perspective. But what certainly in the outreach that I've been involved in, we've heard from the user perspective, is that there's not a lot of incremental value from seeing the gross up on the balance sheet. They're not necessarily seeing much value in that, but there's a lot of value in seeing the incremental changes on the income statement in the profit and loss through things like the development of profit over time, through things like onerous contracts and the like. Now, what we've heard from preparers or what we heard from preparers at the TRG was that the incremental benefit of putting this onto the balance sheet over and above doing in the income statement, the incremental benefit they've heard, as we have, is very low. But because of the nature of the systems, the incremental cost of doing that is significant. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that simply because a insurance contract is in an asset position does not also mean that it's in a loss-making position. Many profitable contracts that are performing exactly as expected will be in an asset position at parts of their life. So as much as it seems like the two issues are related, there's actually quite a big difference in when something is an asset versus when it is profitable. And so those are two different types of data sets and information that's required.
Martin, and let's then come to a vote.
I want to say what Daryl has said. There is not any linkage between the measurement and this presentation. I think it is totally independent. And for many companies, only what is doing this is okay, because you would assume that a kind of liability that after the measurement, I think that is in a liability position. But if you then add kind of premiums receivables, maybe it could come into the asset position. But if you do it on a small group, the likelihood that it could switch to an asset position is higher than if you do it in a big group or a portfolio. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it would allow many companies, okay, to allocate easier and don't to prove that, okay, because you have a small kind of receivable position, adding to a big portfolio liability position, it is very, very likely that the combined position is in a liability position. And that makes it easier, because I also asked the question, if the system are not linked, if you do it on a group level or on a portfolio, they are still not linked. So what is the benefit? And the benefit is you have to allocate then the premiums or receivables to this kind of position, and that makes it on a big portfolio position easier to assume, okay, that it will not change from a liability in an asset position, and then the allocation can be done without linking the systems, and that is a benefit from a cost.
Just one short comment on the Martin's explanation. You said the measurement is independent from the presentation. But Hank said, you don't need to allocate any some kind of a cash flows to, if we just use a kind of portfolio as a presentation level. So if we don't do that kind of allocation, then when we do our allocation to some group level, then the measures of groups might be different.
If I may explain, yes. It's not that you don't need to allocate, but once you move from a group level for presentation to a portfolio, yes, most of your contract will be on the liability side for insurance companies, not talk about reinsurance for a moment, for most of them will be in liability. So you don't need to exercise a lot of judgment or change the system to allocate between assets and liabilities, because most of them will be on liabilities. So it will be easier. You still need to allocate. There would be no floating balances there. Mm-hmm. But it will be much easier, because it's easier to assume or to check most of them are on the liabilities side.
Okay. Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
13.1. Okay. Yep. So we're moving on to the second item of this paper, separate presentation of premium receivable and claims payable. IFRS 17 requires an entity to measure a group of insurance contracts on the basis of all the cash flows expected to arise from fulfilling the contract in the group, including premiums received and claims payable. The presentation in the statement of financial position reflects the combinations of rights and obligations created by the contract as giving rise to a single insurance contract asset or liability. Many entities currently account for premiums receivables and claim payable separately from the rest of the insurance contract asset or liability. Common presentation in the statement of financial position applying IFRS 4 today, as illustrated in paragraph 18 of the paper, include a separate presentation of components of insurance contract. So we'll see the deferred acquisition cost and premium receivables on the asset side of the balance sheet, and we'll see insurance contract liabilities and claims payable on the liability side of the balance sheet. Staff note that there is some inconsistency in how receivables are identified today in practice. Some stakeholders think that the nature of these line items would be better reflected if they were measured and presented separately. For example, stakeholders suggest that measuring and presenting premiums receivable as a separate asset accounted for under IFRS 9 provides better information about the credit risk that the entity bears. Staff think that measuring premiums receivables and claims payable separately from the insurance contract suggests that those components are different and are not related to each other, while they are just different streams of cash flows of the same contract. The principle of IFRS 17 recognizes that a contract, and by extension, groups of contracts, create a single bundle of rights and obligations. Measuring premium receivables and claims payable separately and differently from the corresponding rights and obligations, as if they were standalone assets and liabilities, and presenting them as such is inconsistent with this principle. The staff note that IFRS 17 disclosure requirements, for example, about credit risk, would ensure that useful information about risk related to insurance contract is provided to users of financial statements. The staff do not think that the concerns raised warrant a significant change to the measurement principles in IFRS 17 and that any such change could reduce comparability, unduly disrupt implementation already underway, and risk undue delays in the effective date of IFRS 17. Therefore, the staff recommend that the board should not amend the requirements of IFRS 17 to require separate presentation and separate measurement, different measurement of premiums receivable and claims payable. Benan, I hand it over for you to discussion.
Thank you. One of my hopes, if not objectives, for IFRS 17 is to help bring generalist investors back to the sector who've even given up on it from a fundamental perspective or given up on the sector altogether. I think one of the key benefits of the model we have is that there's this nice consistency. It's a relatively simple, intuitive model to start at a high level. One of the things that is very off-putting to users today is the many terms that appear on the face of the statement of financial position today, not really being familiar with those terms, realizing that some of those are measured in an inconsistent manner. So I would support the staff recommendation that we don't accept this suggestion and that we stick to the framework we have. It brings much greater clarity and it will help bring those generalists back to the sector.
Mary?
Support the staff recommendation. I just wanted to give particular emphasis, and maybe this is again a communication point, to a statement that you have in paragraph 51, the middle sentence in that paragraph. Well, the paragraph 51 in which you are explaining the interaction of, you know, Huggy, your very careful phrasing of not amend to require presentation of the separate line items, because in effect paragraph 51 is addressing the permit, you know, versus require. And I think it's very important that people understand that that permission is subject both to it being necessary to conclude that it's relevant, but also that it's disaggregation kind of within the line item, not in that circumstance you can unwind what is required. So I think that is a way that companies that feel it's important to communicate that they conclude it's relevant, but that it's only within the total, not instead of.
Sue?
Quite a few of the comments that come up on this topic seem to relate to a concern that there's better information today about credit risk because of this sort of separate accounting for the receivable. And I think that it's important to note that because we've got an expected value-based measurement of the insurance contract liability, even though it's sort of done on a combined basis, credit risk is considered as part of that measurement. So I think it's a change in sort of logic and certainly looks different, but it's not as though we've walked away from caring about credit risk. I think that's important to me. And I think the other thing that was really important to me in understanding this issue better, talking to people and reading your paper, is the diversity that we have today in terms of what these actual receivable amounts represent. I'd started off thinking it just meant, you know, I'd already billed somebody, they should have paid me, and they've failed to pay. But the fact that some are actually saying, actually, it's not due yet, but it's going to be due in the next 12 months, and therefore it should be separated out. And the diversity that exists means that I think if we were to do this, we'd have, in that case, if we were discussing that, I think we'd need to have everybody doing the same thing, in which case a number of people presumably would still have systems changes, just different ones to what we're asking them to do. And so I'm not sure there's the same cost relief that we got from the first conversation that we had. So I agree with the staff recommendation not to make a change.
Martin.
Mine, I also agree, because mine, I think our overall model is about expected cash in and outflows. And to now take something of this expected cash in and outflows, and some people think presented it separately, but I don't know if that is really sufficient, because some people say, okay, you should then have that under 9, and mine is also a different model, because mine, we have this 1 year expected loss and all these kind of complications. I think that would be a big impact of our overall concept, how to doing this accounting for insurance contract, and therefore I'm absolutely happy with the staff recommendation not to do it, because I think we should keep that as one model and one thing and not separate some cash flows. And because that was also what I heard during all our debates on this, okay, we should not separate things out because that makes it too difficult, and I think we should be consistent with that and not doing that.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
Agenda paper 2B. So this paper discusses 4 of the 25 topics that have been reported to the board at the October meeting. For those 4 topics, the staff recommend that the board should not amend the requirement in IFRS 17 for the reasons that are discussed in the paper. So I will introduce the 4 topics separately. The first topic is about the requirement to use the lock-in discount rate for measuring adjustment to the contractual service margin when there are changes in estimates that refer to future service. This is discussed from paragraph 5 to paragraph 24 of the paper. And consistent with the feedback during the development of IFRS 17, we heard a significant concern regarding the practicality of using the lock-in discount rate and difficulties of explaining the difference between the change in deferred payment cash flows and the adjustment to the contractual service margin, as discussed in the paper. We've also heard that recent field works show that the amount of this difference could be significant. So some stakeholders would prefer to use current discount rates for measuring adjustment to the contractual service margin. However, the staff analysis in the paper demonstrates that amending IFRS 17, as suggested by those stakeholders, would result in internal inconsistencies in the measurement of the contractual service margin and would damage the consistency in separating the insurance service result from the insurance finance income or expenses, which is one of the improvements introduced by IFRS 17, which is most welcomed by the investors and analysts we have spoken to since the issuance of the standard. Other stakeholders suggest that the contractual service margin is fully remeasured at current rates, similarly to the accounting applying the variable fee approach. However, such amendment would not be appropriate for the general model. So in summary, we recommend that the board should not amend the requirements related to the discount rate used to determine the adjustment to the contractual service margin. And the question for the board is set out on page 11 of the paper. So with that, I would hand over to the board for the discussion of this first topic.
Comments?
Michelle?
Yeah, I support staff's proposal. I think as staff said that the main improvement of IFRS 17 is to separate present the insurance service results and insurance finance economic income and expenses. And when I reach out the users I contacted, I think they believe this kind of information very important and very useful for them. So if we unlock the discount rate, then the changes in discount rate will affect the insurance service result. So I think this kind of improvement will not be achieved. So in this case, I support the staff's recommendation.
Nick?
I mean, this is obviously a concern for some stakeholders, otherwise we wouldn't be discussing it today, but I'm not sure it's a widespread concern. I've not seen that it comes from many groups of stakeholders. I also see from the staff papers that this has been discussed by the board on a number of occasions already. So in that respect, I support the staff proposal.
Any other comments? No. Can we support the staff recommendation?
14. Okay. And the second topic in agenda paper 2B is about the determination of the risk adjustment for a contract that are issued by an entity that is part of a consolidated group. This is discussed on paragraph 25 to paragraph 40 of the paper. The discussion by the Transition Resource Group revealed that stakeholders could read the requirement in IFRS 17 in different ways. Some think that the risk adjustment is determined by the entity issuing the contract, and that this risk adjustment does not change when the entity is consolidated in a group. Others think that in specified circumstances, the risk adjustment in the entity's individual financial statement might differ from the risk adjustment in the consolidated financial statement. Although this might result in possible diversity in practice, we do not recommend amending the requirement about the risk adjustment in IFRS 17 to clarify how to determine the risk adjustment in a group of entities, because this diversity in practice is expected to be limited, as discussed in the paper, and any clarification would not address all the possible differences in the determination of the risk adjustment between entities. Entities, importantly, are required to disclose the approach used to determine the risk adjustment, and this is expected to alleviate potential lack of comparability. So the question for the board is set out on page 16 of the paper, and I would hand over to you for the discussion.
Françoise.
This is a recommendation that I don't support, and I hope it...
Françoise, can you speak up a little bit? We can't hear
I hope that I have the right understanding, but the reason why I don't support it is twofold. The first reaction I have is that we spent quite a lot of effort in supporting implementation in order to trigger convergent, consistent application of our standards. Here we are at the outset. We identified that there were different interpretations. Nevertheless, the staff acknowledges that the way IFRS 17 was intended when it was written, and here we would leave it in the open. And the reason why I also don't support it is that I remember the early days when whether the risk adjustment should be explicitly identified were being discussed, was being discussed. And the reasoning behind making it explicit was largely based on the fact that this was explicitly identified in the pricing of insurance companies, so that pricing takes place at the subsidiary level. So that's where you have the proper documentation and that you can really, you can make that information reliable. So, and I've not really understood in the paper why clarifying it now would be disruptive for people, because you also highlight that, in fact, running different rights is more difficult than running one. So it seems to be also going into the right direction to make one. And I also don't buy the argument that anyway you have different ways of determining risk adjustments, because if that is true, that is true at the subsidiary level. It was never meant to accommodate the fact that you would measure risk at a level different from where the contract is issued. So for all these reasons, unless you tell me that I'm wrong, I don't support.
Sue?
This is the one that I, perhaps of the papers, where I've struggled on the most in terms of working out where I sit. And in my heart, I'm very much where Françoise is, pretty much exactly for the reasons she just articulated, both because of my understanding of 17 and its development, my reading of 17 prior to the TRG and even after the TRG discussions, and putting my interpretation committee hat on. You know, I live and breathe the desire to reduce diversity of application. So that part of me would say we should, you know, be clear if people aren't clear that this is what's required. Then putting my sort of reasonableness hat on again. I think on balance, I
think that IFRIC is unreasonable.
No. I can't be black and white about it. I've lost my train of thought. On balance, I agree with where the staff landed, and the reason why is that, based on my understanding of the discussions, including the ones at the TRG, some people had read the words the other way, and some people have either in the past and or in the implementation of 17 been going forward on a basis where they are measuring the risk adjustment in different ways for the subsidiaries versus the group's accounts. I'm not certain how big the difference in numbers is going to be, so I think this approach enables us to see that over time and to assess that. But in the interim, I'm not sure that the benefits in terms of improving the consistency of application on this, given that it's entity perspectives to start with the risk adjustment, given the disclosures that are provided to investors, and given the potential to cause, I think, disruption for some, is justified at this point in time. So on balance, I agree with the staff recommendation. Not to
Martin?
Yeah, the same as what Sue said, because we had a long discussion also at the THG about that, and also I was wondered how people could read the words and come to different conclusions, but that was what it was, and I have to accept that. But I don't know, do we should now, for all the cases where we have maybe different readings, now change the standard if we got aware of that and we have a THG, and I think we should not do that, because that would really disrupt in the implementation. And also, man, if you look maybe for big issue items, there may be, but here also I don't see that, because man, it is a kind of diversity in practice, yes, maybe, comparability, but is there really a big comparability between really the risk margin of different entities? I don't think so, but they have to disclose, okay, a lot of where, why they come up with a risk margin and what is the basis and the confidential interval and all these kind of issues. So I think there is a lot of disclosure that people are aware what is the risk margin entities use. And therefore, I think taking all this together, I would not amend this now for this issue. So I agree with staff recommendation.
Chambu.
Thank you. A similar point, François said, I agree with that the recommendation, but clarification now sounds good. However, you are saying we'd better wait for the PIR, and you said for some reason here, in paragraph 38, will not help all the possible differences in the determination of the risk adjustment. But this is not persuaded, because I still think, if we give some kind of clarification, the issuing body is the person, the entity, who are in charge of this. That might resolve some of some differences, not all now, but just a part of this difference now, if we just amend clarifying their issuing parties apart.
OK.
Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
Not to amend.
13.
Okay. The next topic is the third topic in the paper, which is linked to the discussion about the subjectivity in the determination of the risk adjustment and also the discount rate. So this is discussed in paragraph from 41 to 59 of the paper. Some investors, analysts, and regulators are concerned that the principle-based nature of IFRS 17 could limit the comparability among insurance entities, given that IFRS 17 requires the use of judgment to determine those key factors in the measurement of insurance contract. We do not recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 to prescribe the discount rates used to measure insurance contract or to limit the number of risk adjustment techniques that entities can use. We think that those amendments might not enable entities to determine the inputs that are most relevant to the circumstance and therefore might reduce the relevance of the financial statement of entities that are issuing insurance contract. So the question for the board is set out on page 21 of the paper, and I would hand over to the board for the discussion of this topic.
Amaru.
Thanks, Anza. I agree with staff, but I'd just like to stress one point. Since inception in the discussion of this project, I always objected to us establishing any pattern, any criteria for defining the discount rate. I think what we stress in paragraph 57, we spent a lot of time in developing the measurement objectives, and I think we should stick to this. This is called core to me to the model. Maybe achieving what you say, comparability without imposing uniformity. This is entity-specific and should be entity-specific. This is my only view. And I just would like to stress in paragraph 58, when in the second sentence you stress, aligned with all the arguments in the papers, that the change is also not recommended because of the systems development and revisit, I don't think this is really a reason for me in this particular subject. The reason to me here is that we should stick to the measurement objective, we should stick to what we proposed. Because if we, at this particular aspect, to me, believe that we should prescribe, then the system itself should be revised, because we would be then changing the standard in a very significant aspect. So totally agree with staff, but I don't think the system's change is a strong argument.
Martin.
Yeah, after the discussion about rate regulation and discount rates today, I think we should change. No, that is a joke.
Well, I think that's demonstrating how difficult it is really to come up with what is the appropriate discount rate in certain situations. And exactly here, I think we have so different scenarios, people investing in different things and have different liabilities. And I think a principle-based approach, which we have done, is the right thing, and we should not and could really not amend.
Who agrees with the staff's recommendation? All of us, finally.
The last topic in the paper is about the OCI option for the presentation of insurance finance income or expenses. That is discussed from paragraph 60 to paragraph 68. Of the paper. So some investors and analysts are concerned that permitting but not requiring a presentation of the effect of some changes in financial assumption in OCI could impair comparability between entities. The board has already exposed for comment alternative accounting treatment to recognize the effect either entirely in profit or loss or partially in OCI in the proposal that preceded IFRS 17. The overall feedback was mixed, and the board concluded that the presentation of insurance finance income or expenses based on a systematic allocation in profit or loss would be more helpful for some contract. So for these reasons, we do not recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 to remove the OCI option. Also, such amendment to IFRS 17 would unduly disrupt implementation processes that are already underway. IFRS 17 requires to provide information about the amounts recognized in OCI so that users of financial statement have the basis to adjust the information reported by entities that use the OCI option to make them comparable with those that do not use the OCI option. The question for the board is on page 23 of the paper, and I would hand over to you for the discussion on this last topic.
Mary?
Just to the last thing that Roberta said before she handed over, she's emphasized something that's in paragraph 64 of the paper, that when we decided to create an option for OCI, we established disclosure requirements that will allow a user of financial statements to adjust the information reported if they they disagree and want to include that movement in profit or loss. I think it is important, and I apologize, I intended to do this and didn't get to it, to go back and look again at the wording of the disclosure requirement to make sure it is as clear as it is in the staff paper, that that is what you have to achieve with the disclosure if you elect the OCI option. I just haven't come back and looked at that, but I think that's very important that we're saying that that's the disclosure requirement.
Nick?
Clearly, this is quite a difficult issue. I think it's indisputable that offering an accounting choice undermines comparability. I struggle to find a conceptual basis for offering that choice. I do see that making a change here would be disruptive. I think that's also clear. I'm not sure it's disruptive to the mechanics of implementation, but I could see it being disruptive nevertheless. And the only offsetting, alleviating factor is the disclosure, that it puts a user in a position to bring back comparability as they may see it. So I find this a very difficult one.
Anne?
I agree with Nick that there is no conceptual basis for this, but equally there are mixed views, and the board is already aware of that, and I think it would be disruptive to make a change, so I'll be supporting the staff recommendation.
I support the staff's recommendation, but I hope that investors will force the insurance companies to make as little use of this option as possible. Okay, can I see who?
13.
Anne.
So paper 2C looks at two issues relating to the variable fee approach, its scope and the risk mitigation option within it. The paper does not consider these matters in relation to reinsurance contracts held, and we will be bringing a paper on various aspects of accounting for reinsurance contracts held to a future board meeting. So don't think about these issues in relation to reinsurance contracts held in thinking about this paper. The first issue is the scope of the variable fee approach, and that's set by the definition of insurance contracts with direct participation features. Participation features exist in many insurance contracts, both ones that meet the definition of contracts with direct participation features and contracts that don't meet that definition. And the effect of participation features is always included in the measurement of the fulfillment cash flows. So it's not that we ignore the effect of participation. The board introduced the variable fee approach in response to feedback as it was developing IFRS 17, that some contracts include participation features to an extent that meant they are substantially investment-related service contracts, under which the entity provides a service that is in effect equivalent to an asset management service. The definition of insurance contracts with direct participation features captures those type of contract, and then the modifications to the general model that are included in the variable fee approach result in the depiction of the service in the contract as an asset management service. We have heard, consistent to what we were hearing also as we developed IFRS 17, that the scope of the variable fee approach, some people think, is too narrow, and that economically similar contracts end up being reported in different ways because some meet the definition of insurance contracts with direct participation features and some don't. The staff does not recommend a change to the scope of the variable fee approach. The staff thinks that the definition of insurance contracts with direct participation features captures those contracts that provide a service equivalent to asset management services. And it is only for those contracts that the variable fee approach and the way the variable fee approach differs from the general model is appropriate. We've seen many examples of contracts that fall on either side of the line. We haven't seen any examples for which we think the application of the definition gives an inappropriate classification. Just to note that one difference between the variable fee approach and the general model is the type of service that determines the allocation of the contractual service margin. So under the variable fee approach, you include investment-related services in that determination, and under IFRS 17 for the general model, you don't. We are going to bring a paper on that aspect of the general model to a future board meeting. We think that question is something that should be addressed in the context of the general model rather than by changing the scope of the variable fee approach. We think the combined aspects of the variable fee approach as a whole is appropriate only for insurance contracts that meet the definition of insurance contracts with direct participation features. So does the board agree with the question that's in paragraph 18 of the paper?
Martin. Yeah, I agree, because when we developed the standards, there was this big debate about the variable fee approach. We had representatives from industry here, which they convinced us, okay, that okay, de facto, these kind of contracts are asset management contracts, and that is a kind what they earn is a fee, because they do asset management services. I think we were convinced that certain criteria are fulfilled. It is like an asset management contract, and therefore we developed the variable fee approach. But for me, it is now difficult to understand what is a kind of reinsurance of an asset management contract. I have never understood it. And now to say, okay, to open the model for some reinsurance contract for an asset management contract is difficult. Maybe there are some circumstances, then they argue now it is an accounting mismatch, but that is not the topic for me. I think if they are not fulfilling this kind of asset management contract, which we have debated, I think they should account for that different. And the accounting mismatch is for me not a good argument here, because I came from the first place. I think it was, they convinced me is asset management with a variable fee, and we agreed to that, and therefore we have the accounting, but for me, it is too difficult to understand what a reinsurance of an asset management contract is, and therefore, by principle, I am against this amendment. And accounting mismatches, which is not an argument for me in this regard.
And John.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with that proposal. I think why people ask this question, because they think that some contracts are economically similar, but why they are accounted for differently. But I think the issue is not relevant to the definition of the of an insurance contract with direct participation features, because it's relevant to the introduction of the VFA. Because we introduce the VFA, then we have to draw a line, then we have to define clearly of the insurance contract with direct participation features. So I agree with current existing definition. In the meanwhile, I appreciate and just said that I think people why they rate the issue because there are some insurance contracts do have significant investment service inside. So they are worried about maybe. The period of those services they provide longer than the insurance service. So I appreciate that the staff explore, analyze those issues, and we'll bring paper in the future board meetings.
Daryl,
I agree with where the staff have landed on this one. I accept that there are contracts that in some ways, when one looks at what the intent of the insurer is in the way they manage it, may look like they have very similar outcomes, and therefore people are arguing that they should be managed the same way. But I think from my perspective, there is a very significant difference between how the insurer thinks they are going to manage the contract versus what the expectations are of the counterparty in their contract. And I've, like you, looked at a number of different examples that people have raised, and I think we are drawing the appropriate line. So I accept there is a difference, but we knew that when we went into writing the standard. We knew that by having these two models, there was going to be a crossover point, and I think the crossover point is at the correct place.
Mary?
I want to build on what Daryl was saying, because I think, you know, once you pick a crossover point, you're going to get things that sit either side of the line that, especially in normal times, look pretty similar from an economic perspective. And to me, when we draw a line somewhere, to say the line is drawn on the basis of the distinction between contractual rights and obligations and expected behavior based on practice, commercial incentives, et cetera, is probably the strongest place we can find to draw a line. So I think we have it in the right place, and I don't want to think about moving it.
Can we agree with the staff recommendation?
14.
The second issue in the paper is the applicability of the risk mitigation option in the variable fee approach. So the board considered whether to develop a general bespoke risk mitigation accounting approach for insurers when developing IFRS 17. And we know that risk mitigation is a fundamental aspect of much insurance activity. However, the board concluded that any broad approach to risk mitigation activities of insurers should be approached as part of a broader approach to accounting for risk mitigation activities generally across all entities. Nonetheless, the board did include an option in the variable fee approach so that an entity could avoid an accounting mismatch that would otherwise be created by that approach. So, to the extent that an entity hedges financial risk in an insurance contract with direct participation features with a derivative, it can, if specified conditions are met, take the effect of changes in those financial risks to profit or loss, where the change in the derivative is recognized, rather than adjusting the contractual service margin. Some stakeholders think that the board should extend this risk mitigation option to cover contracts under the general model or to cover more risk. Now, as I noted, we'll talk about how risk mitigation questions relate to reinsurance contracts held at a future meeting. In relation to other aspects of risk mitigation, the staff do not think the board should try to develop further accounting for risk mitigation activities in this project, but should instead address them as part of its broader approach to accounting for risk mitigation activities. So there are two questions on risk mitigation activities in the paper. The first is about the non-transitional aspects, and that's set out in paragraph 28 of the paper. So if I could get your views on that question first.
So just commenting on question two. So I agree with the staff recommendation. At the time that we developed this, it was very much a direct response to the decisions that we made on the variable fee approach to deal specifically with the new mismatch that we created. So it was knowingly very targeted and specific to that. I'm not sure that I've heard anything new. We knew at the time that some would have liked us to do more, and I don't think there's any new information for me to suggest we should make any changes. So I agree with question two.
Do we agree with question two?
And then the second question on the risk mitigation activities is about the retrospective application of the risk mitigation. IFRS 17 prohibits retrospective application because of the possibility of cherry-picking the contracts to which it applies. And this is consistent with the board's approach to hedging activities taken in IFRS 9. So the question on the transitional aspects is in paragraph 30 of the paper.
Martin.
And in principle, I agree with the staff recommendation, but I also would like to have maybe a broader discussion when we're discussing possible amendments on the transition. Because, man, I think what this requirement has in mind is that we, if we don't allow retrospective applications, then the ZSM for the stable fee contracts are impacted if they are really have an effective hedge on if we would allow that. So it could be, I think, a material impact on the ZSM. And we also know that the ZSM can be then or has an influence on the future performance P&L of this insurance contract. So it can, I think, have, based on our criteria, maybe improve also kind of information value of the ZSM, because if it is effectively or economically hedged and we would enable companies to do that also in accounting, I think our criteria would be fulfilled, because then, okay, it will enhance. I also know that we have these problems of cherry picking with hindsight, but I would ask the staff, maybe you can have a further look into that, maybe because we have also decided now to defer first-time application of the new standard, and maybe we can come up with rules saying, okay, if this is in place 2 years before effective date and before, then maybe we can not fully, I think, hinder this kind of hindsight and cherry-picking, but maybe we can come up with some ideas to improve that, because I think there is a potential that we can improve. Andrea looks not so enthusiastic, but I think we should discuss it in when we discuss overall transition, because I think there are other issues which make maybe transition difficult, or maybe the information which come out of transition okay more useful.
Daryl?
So I understand where Martin's coming from. I can understand why we would see there being, why the perfect solution would be to be able to apply retrospective accounting to your hedge decision. I think the difficulty we're dealing with here is that you are looking at two completely different accounting models before and afterwards. And I think even if you were to consider what is a hedge before, it may not be a hedge afterwards, and vice versa. So I struggle a little bit to understand, in the first instance, how you could think of that mitigation being in place before and not afterwards, or afterwards and not before kind of thing. But I do understand it'll have an impact. I mean, my real concern is I don't know that we can ever get past this hindsight issue, because I think essentially what you're doing is you're putting people into a cherry-picking position. And we've seen this with other standards. We know that other standards, when we come to thinking about transition, there may be an answer that if you could find the perfect way to apply perfect retrospective accounting, you may come to a different conclusion. But hindsight means that there is no way of being able to put yourself in the position you would otherwise have been. And I think that's particularly important where accounting changes. I think in terms of the broader transition discussion, I'm not sure this comes in a broad sense, but I do think there's at least one of the topics that you're likely to bring back to us, which is the reset of OCI. Yep. That has an almost identical problem. You have exactly the same issue where there is the opportunity for cherry picking or for applying hindsight or whatever term you want to use, and in that circumstance you would also get very different answers depending on how you pick it, and you can define the outcome you want using the information that you have. So I could in some way see why those two issues might be linked, and we might want to discuss them together. At the same time, personally, I don't like either of them. So I'd probably be inclined to say no to both. But
you haven't got the paper on the other one yet.
Sue?
I'd agree with Martin that this is an important question because of the potential effect on CSM and the potential long-term effect on profitability as a result. I share Daryl's, but because of that, I think it makes me particularly cautious, and I do share Daryl's nervousness and scepticism, if I can paraphrase, that particularly for an approach which is optional, the risk of hindsight and cherry-picking is a very real one, particularly in the consequence of a long-term potential effect on profitability. Having said all of that, I think there is some sort of linkages in terms of logic and analysis between this issue and at least one of the other issues I know that we're going to be looking at on transition.
Yep.
And so I don't think it's a bad idea to park this for the minute and to come back with some more detailed analysis in the context of transition comments we've received more generally to look at it sort of as a suite, if you like.
My point is, my Esther, is that if we could come to a different conclusion on this OCI and have now voted on this, I think it does not make sense. So it is the same issue, and I think we should discuss it together.
So this means we don't vote on this?
Don't vote on question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Paper 2D. So paper 2D covers issues relating to business combinations. The paper looks at two specific issues on classification of contracts and the resulting liabilities in a business combination that have been frequently raised with us. The staff were aware that there could be other classification issues relating to insurance contracts in the business combination. We think that the principles set out in this paper would in fact apply to all classifications of insurance contracts in a business combination. So looking at the first of the two specific issues in the paper, this relates to the classification of contracts acquired in a business combination as insurance contracts or not insurance contracts. IFRS 17 requires that classification to be based on terms and conditions at the acquisition date, and it does that by removing an exception from that general principle that is in IFRS 3. There used to be an exception for insurance contracts, and IFRS 17 amended IFRS 3 to take that exception out. Some stakeholders think that this adds complexity for users because similar contracts could be accounted for differently by the consolidated entity depending on whether they were issued or acquired. They also note that the contracts could be accounted for differently by the consolidated group and the individual subsidiary that issued them. The staff note that such differences are not unique to insurance contracts and are a consequence of the principle in IFRS 3 that the acquirer accounts for what it has acquired on the acquisition date. Therefore, we do not recommend a change to either IFRS 17 or IFRS 3 in this regard. The question for the board is in paragraph 15 of the paper.
So I would agree with the staff recommendation. I think one of the objectives of IFRS 17 was to bring insurance accounting more in line with the accounting and other circumstances. I think the concerns raised here are genuine. There's going to be some real impact of these concerns in terms of operational stuff. But that is equally the case, I think, for other industries, and they have exactly the same problem in dealing with acquisitions. So I'm comfortable with where the staff recommendation lands.
Anne?
Yes, as Daryl said, yes. I agree with the staff recommendation because I think it's important that the exemption's removed from IFRS 3 so that acquisition accounting of IFRS 3 is applied by these entities.
Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14. The second issue in paper 2D relates to the classification of a liability in an insurance contract which is acquired in its settlement phase, i.e. after an insured event has occurred. The contract is an insurance contract at the date of acquisition because there is insurance risk relating to adverse development of claims. Consistent with the principle in IFRS 3 that we've referred to just now, IFRS 17 requires the acquiring entity to treat the liability as a liability for remaining coverage, the coverage being the coverage for the adverse development of claims. Even though the liability might be treated as a liability for incurred claims in the acquiree's financial statements. Again, some stakeholders think this treatment adds complexity and additional costs. And here, I think there's additional costs, especially if all the contracts that an entity issues rather than acquires are eligible for the premium allocation approach. the entity would need to create systems for the general model just for contracts that it acquires. As with the previous issue, the staff thinks that the loss of useful information resulting from not applying the principles in IFRS 3 consistently to insurance contracts would be substantial, and hence we do not recommend a change to IFRS 17. Just to note that we, in this paper, we're not discussing the transitional arrangements for that classification as liability for remaining coverage or liability for incurred claims. We'll be discussing transitional arrangements in a future board paper.
Doc. Thank you. I agree with the recommendation based on the principle of IFRS 3. However, I have more sympathy to this issue than the issue of Agenda Paper 2A, because this issue could be ongoing issue, because once you have different carrying value for each individual contract, then you have to keep it until the contract disappear. And whenever you have new acquisition, you have the same issues. And especially this is the issue of the settlement period. And the accounting treatment is completely different, like you explained. So therefore, I have more sympathy to this issue. Having said that, I support staff's recommendation. Then what we could do is we could provide some expedient so that the entity can follow. Because if we read IFRS, the literature strictly, paragraph 38, 39, and B 93 and B 5, then it seems like you have to treat individual contract as if you acquired those contracts. So that means you have to do it very individual contract basis. But looking back to the principle of IFRS 3, you don't really have to do that, because in the principle of IFRS 3, it is a business combination accounting. So if you could provide some expedient to get the similar outcome, then that could alleviate the cost of preparers.
Well, I have similar comments to make. Basically, I agree with the staff that we should not revisit the decision that have been made for IFRS 17 in general. But I really think that for those entities which, other than in purchasing portfolios of contracts or entering a business combination, those entities would not need to have contractual service margin software. I think these should be benefit from a practical expedient of sort. I don't know what that practical expedient should be, but I don't think I think we are talking of entities which are rather smaller than others, so probably have less resources than others, and that could be regarded as bringing an obstacle to the extent to which they can carry their business activities. And so I think it's kind of a duty to provide a practical expedient.
Sue?
I agree with the staff recommendation. I don't think we should be making any amendments in this respect, and I don't think we should be introducing new expedients at this point. I wanted to comment in particular on the comment that some stakeholders raised about the similarities with the discussion that the Transition Resource Group had, because I don't think they are that similar.
Yeah.
They're certainly cousins, but I don't think it's the same issue. And I was trying to remember what the example was that we used in the TRG. I can't remember whether it was fire or earthquake, but one or the other, some sort of horrible event. If you write an insurance contract, you've got two things going on. One is whether or not the fire or the earthquake occurs. That's one thing. And then the second thing is the sort of adverse development, how much do I end up having to pay out under the claims? And the discussion at the TRG was about whether or not that second step was considered to be insurance coverage or not, and that was what the TRG was focusing on. But obviously the difference in this case is that if I've come in and the earthquake or the fire has already occurred, then the only unknown is what does a claim turn out to be. And for it to be an insurance contract, there has to be insurance coverage, and that has to be what's covered. So for me, it's not the same issue. And I think we should explain that, because I can see how people could be confused, but I think it's an important distinction.
I agree with what Sue said. No argument at all. However, the problem is granularity, because in the acquisition, you may acquire millions of, not million, maybe hundreds of thousands of contracts, which are already in the settlement period. So if you require them to go, you know, individual contract or group basis, it's a bit too much. So if there is any interpretation which you can make a little more aggregated basis, that would help prepare us.
Martin?
I think also, man, that is not that everybody wants to have this treatment, because, man, I could imagine that if you buy in kind of insurance portfolio via an acquisition or other way around, that you want to earn kind of CSM over time. And if you would have a practical expedience that you have treated always as a liability for incurred claims, and if you're expecting to make a profit, should you then realize the profit immediately or book it against goodwill? So I think this expedience is would be difficult. Man, if we, I would then, if we, I have sympathy if we can help maybe companies who have retail business and have it in this, but then we have to come up with an option. But now to have an expedience with an option in, man, that is a little bit too much, because, man, as I said, we have principles in three, and I think all other industries have to apply that, and why we should make it here and not for others, because, man, it was an expedience with an option, which I think would be difficult.
Can I ask Tack a question? Yeah. Is the point that you're making, Tack, that if I acquire a portfolio of insurance contracts in a business combination, this would suggest that you need to know for every single contract whether or not the fire has actually occurred or not?
Yeah, that's okay, but if you acquire the entity basis, so entity basis,
business combination,
in the business combinations, and the, you have variety of groups and contract, you have to go into the detail of the, see the individual contract and see the group again, and redo everything, because it's a completely new model. The entity has been applying PAA model, and the company itself is applying PAA model, all of a sudden it's going to be general model, and then completely different accounting procedure. And you have to go down to the individual contract and make a annual cohort and group. That is my understanding. If I'm wrong, then that's okay. But some people understand in such a way, so therefore they have some concern.
Martin?
Man, in principle, I agree, but why is it different, man? If you compare it with a bank, a big retail bank in acquisition, you have also to look at the individual loans, come up with your own fair value, maybe then coming up with going forward, what is your incurred loss, not incurred, expected loss model for this individual loan. So it is not, why is it in insurance industry different from all other industry? Because also in other industry, you would deal with a kind of many contracts which you have to look at. And why is it in insurance? When I have sometimes the impression that insurance is more difficult than other industries, and I'm not convinced about it.
It has not been subject to change for a long time.
I just wanted to perhaps respond a little bit to what that's saying, and I want to be very careful in how I respond, because I don't want to be interpreting the standard on the fly. But I'm not sure. I think the entity that is doing the acquisition is essentially initiating the contract on the date of acquisition. Yes. So in the first instance, that means since the date of acquisition is what sets the annual cohort, I suspect they would have to consider whether this was all one.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's probably important here is we're talking only about, in these circumstances, contracts that are already in their claim period.
Yes.
So the underlying is identified. That means that the underlying entity has probably already grouped those contracts together in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the entity in terms of, because there's no claims, there's no premiums here, the premiums have all occurred beforehand. But what substitutes for the premium is the payment that the entity receives from the acquiree to compensate them for taking that over. And I think that would also be applied. So I'm not sure that I would end up with a myriad of little, of individual contracts. I think think the standard would, in many circumstances, and again, I want to be really careful here about interpreting, but in many circumstances, would allow at least some form of grouping.
But anyway, they have to calculate CSM.
Correct.
Yes.
Absolutely.
CSM, so that part they have to estimate for that group, the you know, coverage period.
Yes.
Yes. Because.
Yes, I think that's the point. The practical expedient that I can't feature is the one that would have as an objective that people do not have to invest in the software necessary for running the general model when otherwise they could rely only on the premium allocation approach. And, I mean, if today we say no, we're not going there, I would suggest that we keep in the consultation a door open so that if we wanted to conclude differently, maybe call for suggestion or whatever, so that if we would conclude differently in the end, we would not be in a re-exposure.
Okay. Who agrees with the staff's recommendation?
13.
Okay, so agenda paper 2E next. Agenda paper 2E discusses one of the three topics that are on the measurement of reinsurance contracts held. That's included in the list of 25 that have been reported. This paper discusses the future cash flows that are included in the measurement of reinsurance contracts held. Analysis on the other two reinsurance topics, which relate to the accounting for the contractual service margin, will be brought to a future meeting. The focus of those future topics is on stakeholder concerns that the risk mitigation nature of reinsurance contracts is not being reflected in the way that they would have expected because of the requirements for accounting for the contractual service margin of those reinsurance contracts held. Today, the discussion is on the future cash flows that are included in the contract boundary. Applying IFRS 17's contract boundary requirements, the future cash flows included in the measurement of a reinsurance contract held include all of the cash flows that arise from both the insurer's substantive rights and substantive obligations as the holder of that contract. In some circumstances, the insurer has substantive rights under the reinsurance contract, which relate to the reinsurance of underlying insurance contracts that the insurer hasn't issued yet. As an example, the insurer might have a right to receive reinsurance services at a predetermined price. Looking at this from both sides of the transaction, the reinsurer has an obligation to cover those future insurance contracts, and the insurer, as the holder of the contract, has a right to receive the cover from the reinsurer. In those circumstances, the cash flows that are included in the measurement of the reinsurance contract held will include the cash flows that relate to those future underlying insurance contracts. And this means that the contractual service margin, which for reinsurance contracts held represents the cost of purchasing that reinsurance, will reflect the total expected cost that the insurer expects to incur for entering into that reinsurance contract. Stakeholders have expressed concerns about applying the contract boundary requirements in IFRS 17 to reinsurance contracts held for two reasons. The first reason is that they think the requirements are operationally complex because of the difficulties in measuring uncertain future cash flows. Today, insurers typically don't estimate cash flows relating to insurance contracts not yet issued. Instead, reinsurance contracts held are often measured using a mirroring approach. The second reason is that they think the requirements will create a grossed-up reinsurance asset, and this is the topic that was discussed in the education session on Tuesday. In this paper, the staff recommend that the board should not amend the requirements in IFRS 17 relating to the future cash flows that are included in the measurement of reinsurance contracts held, and would like to ask board members whether you agree with this recommendation.
Professor.
I agree with the recommendation. I would just want to make a comment relating to how we justify, in fact, this decision. As you show in the paper, there are three issues that have been raised. The first one is about complexity, and the two others is about, in fact, the fiscal representation on the balance sheet and income statement. So they are of a different nature. My understanding is that our response to issue two and three is basically that there is no distortion whatsoever, and I would keep that argument absolutely sufficient. And I would keep the arguments that you put under paragraph 23, more particularly B and C, justifying why we are not relaxing the complexity aspect.
Mary?
I just wanted to observe, Laura, you mentioned in passing the education session we did on Tuesday.
Yes.
And to say that I found the slides, they're attached to this paper, but they also are posted separately in the insurance section, very helpful in walking through, albeit in a simplified example, how the existing requirements of 17 would apply in that circumstance in which you have arranged reinsurance that will cover contracts that have not, the underlying contracts not yet issued. And to me, it pretty clearly answered and dispelled the concerns that we're, you know, that you're summarizing here about gross up. So I just want to do some additional advertising for those slides, because I think they are very, you know, they are very effective in terms of walking through and understanding the application of the standard.
Okay. Can we support the staff? Sorry?
Presumably not everybody didn't follow through our thinking in terms of the fact that you need to think about inflows and outflows, even though I know some have, and I agree with Mary, it was really helpful. Does this hold in all scenarios? Is there anything like rate changes or anything like that where...
I think interest, for example, changes in interest rates would have an impact. Because essentially what you've got is you've got projected future cash flows, you're remeasuring those cash flows taken. And because we are not remeasuring CSM, you'll see the difference come out of the difference, that difference in CSM. The question, I guess, would be whether or not we're comfortable that reflects the underlying reality of what's happening with that contract. And I think that's what we would say, is that if you were to have written this contract at a different date, you may have taken different interest rates into consideration. What you've done is you've locked in what your assumptions are, and therefore there is a real economic effect of those rates that you have locked in at that point.
So I think for me it follows from the rationale that we've got for why we do the CSM that way, right? So that's sort of a consequence of all of that, but it doesn't undermine our logic here.
Precisely.
For the insurance contract.
It is the same logic essentially of what we were thinking about under the paper 2B, I think, in terms of the CSM approach.
So the fact that the balance is zero does not mean that you don't have an asset or liability. It is existing, it's just the balance at the beginning is zero. Yes.
Doc?
Yeah. I have already mentioned a little in the education session, so I should be quick. But maybe the underlying very difficult problem of this insurance is because we don't have accounting in the position of a policyholder. And if you are a general entity who has a risky business and have an insurance contract which covers your risky business, then that would change your business itself. But because we IFRS do not cover such kind of insurance, so there is no accounting treatment, no estimation of cash flow at all. Having said that, in the case of reinsurance, we measure cash flows because there is an underlying insurance contract. So therefore, the presumption is there is an underlying insurance contract, which, and then reinsurance is only to cover that underlying contract. So the difficulty of Agenda Paper 2E issue is sometimes reinsurance contract is made earlier than the underlying contract. So there is no underlying contract, but there is a reinsurance contract. So if you just look at the point in time, that is exactly the same as the policy normal policy holder's position. So, but we assume that this is the insurance. So therefore, we gross up the cash flow and make this all this arrangement. And that's fine, but the difficulty probably is we need to consider whether the reinsurance is really effective or not. It's exactly the same mechanism like a macro hedge or a hedge accounting. So if we were to do it, you know, complete solution, if we were to provide a complete solution, we have to make such a mechanism. So it's not possible. That's why we do not do that. So we do not touch it. Maybe in the post-implementation review or whatever in the future, I don't know, 10 years later or so, but that is what we need to revisit. But for now, it's not possible. Therefore, I agree with staff's recommendation.
Daryl?
So I agree with the staff recommendation. I've started out thinking about this one. I tend to start from a slightly different perspective, which is from the perspective of the reinsurer. The reinsurer is applying IFRS 17. They have to apply IFRS 17 to all future cash flows. Therefore, including in that application, they're applying it to these cash flows that for contracts that have not yet been written. That's clearly a part of their obligation, and we are not questioning that in any way. I then revert and look at the other side of that same transaction and say, if anything, the primary insurer probably has more information, knows more about what their expectations are and more about what they're going to write. And then to Tuck's point, I'm not sure I 100% agree. I think actually what we're saying is that, like we said on other contracts and like we said in other standards and like we're sometimes being criticized on other standards, is if you have two similar things on your balance sheet, one is an asset and one is a liability, account for them the same way. And I think essentially what this is saying is account for them using the same principles, using the same underlying arguments. So I'm definitely not going to be here in 10 years' time if this is error, but I'm not sure I would think any differently. I think this is the appropriate answer.
I see. Okay. Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
14. On to our last paper then, agenda paper 2F. Agenda paper 2F discusses the treatment of accounting estimates in interim financial statements. Applying IAS 34, the frequency of an entity's reporting shall not affect the measurement of its annual results. During the development of IFRS 17, the board received feedback that applying this requirement would result in a significant practical burden when an entity reports more than annually, for reasons that are set out in paragraphs 5-7 of this paper. In response to those concerns, the board decided that IFRS 17 should specifically prohibit entities from changing the treatment of accounting estimates made in previous interim financial statements when applying IFRS 17 in subsequent interim financial statements or in annual financial statements. Stakeholders have expressed concerns that applying the requirements in IFRS 17 raises practical difficulties in some circumstances, and different stakeholders have proposed different amendments. Some stakeholders think the requirements should be extended to apply not only to IAS 34 interim reports, but also to apply to other types of interim reports. For example, monthly management reports or internal reports provided from a subsidiary to a parent. Other stakeholders think the requirements should be amendments so that the application is permitted rather than required. In this paper, the staff recommend that the board should not amend the requirements in IFRS 17 relating to the treatment of accounting estimates in interim financial statements, and would like to ask board members whether you agree with this recommendation.
No discussion. We all violently agree.
No. Oh. I just want to check my understanding of how this rolls out when you have a group. So let's say I have a UK insurer that reports to its parent, which I'll put in Germany in Martin's honor. The UK company does not report separately. The group does interim reporting, including the UK.
Yes.
Subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to year end, the sub, from a group perspective, the information that was used at the interim financial date for the group consolidated financial statements would not be changed, even though the sub that reported it had not done its own interim reporting.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That. Yeah.
So you make this determination of how have I done interim reporting before from the perspective of the entity that is reporting, rather than looking at the underlying component. Now, if that UK subsidiary were doing its own annual reporting, then it would have an adjustment because it had not done interim reporting.
Yes.
At all.
Okay. So essentially, the subsidiary would be retaining two lots of information, one right. for the group level and one for their
which
own
is why
level.
Some people suggested an amendment. But I thought it was important to confirm that the fact that the UK sub had not done its own interim reporting has no impact on what the group does, yes. because yes. it's whether the group has done interim reporting or not yes. that is determinative
yes.
for the group purposes.
Daryl?
I understand some of the complexity in what people are suggesting in this space, but the more I've spoken to various people around in terms of what the actual impact on the ground is likely to be of this, because of the fact that many entities are not doing these regular re-estimations on regular reporting periods, is that the impact is actually a lot smaller than what it would appear on the face of it. And I think any solution that we're trying to develop in this space would likely have to be very rules-based with a lot of various, and just would add a lot of complexity to the standard. So I support where the staff have arrived on this one.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this discussion. Thank you very much. Let's have a break at 3 o'clock.
Good papers.
Good papers.
Yes.